Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to see you all here, and this is the first biennial meeting of the Global Health Law Committee, which is a new committee of the ILA established about 2 years ago. I welcome you also on behalf of my co-chair, Bridget Cleves, of the Netherlands. Unfortunately, she couldn't be here today. And Dapo has already introduced by co-panelists Ruth Atherton and Zavi Suluba. Zavi is one of our co-rapporteurs, and our other co-rapporteur is Helena Thone, who I think many of you probably know, and I will revert to some of her work momentarily. A key impetus for establishing the committee was to try to bring global health law forward as a field of international law, a specific discipline. We know we consider today international economic law, international environmental law, international intellectual property law, and so forth, to be disciplines in the field of international law. The protection and promotion of public health has not been really viewed as a specific discipline of international law. And we wanted to try through the work of this committee to bring global health law into the mainstream. And a good part of that was to create an equal playing field, not only as a matter of public international law, but particularly we see in intergovernmental negotiations involving trade, mercantile interests, investment, intellectual property rights, and so forth. We tend to see a focus on those interests and financial interests and not public health interests. And in good measure, we think that's incommensurate with the importance of public health. I suppose it's an old saw that you can have all of the money in the world, but if you don't have your health, you won't really appreciate all of your money. And just in the same way, we think that public health law is more vital to the international community, or at least as vital to the international community as these other interests. So, for those of you who are not so much involved in global health law and health law in general, of all the fields of both domestic and international regulation, very few have the breadth and depth of the regulation of health. And this runs through a whole variety of areas, whether it's in the establishment and functioning of national health care systems, in mechanisms for the production and distribution of healthcare goods and services, including trade in health goods and services, including pharmaceutical products. A great deal of attention is paid to innovation and access in the field of health-related technologies. We have a great deal of concern over the past several years with respect to preparation for and response to both domestic and global health emergencies. We're looking very strongly at addressing the impact of environmental degradation and climate change on public health. Those of you, and I expect everyone in the room, are world travelers, are familiar now with going to some of the largest cities in the world, particularly in developing countries, and finding difficulty breathing after taking a mile walk on the street. And increasingly, degradation of the environment is becoming a serious public health challenge, and one of the things our committee is looking to. And as you all know, there's been a big transition. And I think we may tend to underplay this a bit, thinking that current history is all of history. But the establishment of the World Trade Organization and the adoption of the Agreement on Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property Rights really entailed a sea change in the way the international community approached public health. The authority to make rules directly impacting health-related goods and services, and particularly with the advent of the TRIPS Agreement, effectively moved the regulation of this area from an international organization primarily devoted to public health to an organization primarily devoted to protecting mercantile interests. This was really done in the health sphere at the instigation of the major pharmaceutical companies who were looking to more broadly extend patents and marketing exclusivity protection. But these changes have brought tremendous impact on global health systems throughout the developing world. And while we talk about it all the time, I think it's important to recognize that this is a change that's only come about since 1995. That is, before the TRIPS Agreement, about half the countries in the world exempted pharmaceuticals from patenting. And now, through the TRIPS Agreement, it's essentially a given that that protection will be provided. And so we've seen, then, to turn to the field of trade, in recent negotiations and trade agreements, we see, for example, most recently, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. You have a real focus in the body of the agreements in restricting public health flexibilities. So in the TPP, probably the most contentious provisions in the trade negotiations related to the extension of biological exclusivity, a biological drug marketing exclusivity, and making it more difficult to introduce biogeneric drugs. We've also had a lot of controversy about investor-to-state dispute settlement in the field of public health, and the TPP carrying forward provisions from the Australia-US FTA and the Korea-US FTA has new transparency provisions which allow third parties to intervene in decisions about health authorities, about what types of drugs to put on their reimbursement formularies. And these types of decisions have a very big impact on national public health systems. So this looks as a focus of the international economic system these days. When we started to meet as the committee, and I'll revert to our initial and subsequent work, we've actually been quite an active committee, although we are a relatively newly formed committee. We initially decided to focus on four subject matter tracks, and Ruth Atherton will be addressing this first issue, legal issues surrounding access to research materials, including biological materials and the results of clinical research. And so these are aspects dealing with a wide range of subject matter, but including the relationship between the Convention on Biological Diversity and the Pandemic Influenza Preparedness Framework at the WHO, and how we treat biological materials from the standpoint of patenting, and how we treat access to clinical research and so forth. So Ruth will be talking about that. Then we have legal issues surrounding access to essential medicines, and I'll be reverting to that in the context of the UN High-Level Panel on Access to Medicines. We have legal issues surrounding the tensions between trade and investment agreements in global public health, and Zavi will be addressing that. And then something we'll be discussing a little bit less this morning, but which is very clearly on the work program of the committee, is state obligations in the field of health and the links with human rights law, including new developments with respect to the greater attention to non-communicable diseases, and, as I mentioned a bit earlier, to sustainable development. The first major activity of the committee was to organize or co-organize a meeting of a significant group of stakeholders active in addressing the Ebola crisis, and this meeting took place in Geneva in February of 2015. And what we did, and we were fortunate at that time to be able to bring together the parties that were really directly active and responsible for addressing the Ebola crisis, including Doctors Without Borders, the WHO, including their Essential Medicines Division, and the people involved in trying to promote the introduction of new vaccines and treatments and the approval of clinical trials and so forth, the people involved in developing new vaccines, including Gavi, and an array of the organizations that were actively involved in setting up the response to the crisis on the ground, and to really try to get very closely into what was going on, and from our standpoint specifically, what improvements might be useful for the international legal framework in terms of addressing future global health crises. And there's a brief report of that meeting. It's a non-attribution report included in our report, but just a few highlights of that. There was a very strong consensus among everybody involved that the first order of priority in improving global public health emergency responsiveness was the strengthening of national health care systems, because in terms of the simple things like surveillance before you even address response, without a well-functioning national system, you don't have adequate surveillance and you don't have adequate response, and that includes as well the training personnel. Then critical need to accelerate pathways for R&D on new vaccines and treatments and new diagnostics and how you go about that. And that continues to be an issue, of course. Then how do you manage these interventions? You may recall that this was a very unusual case, for example. It's the first time we're aware of where Doctors Without Borders, MSF, asked the U.S. military to intervene and provide on-the-ground support for intervention in the Ebola crisis. And why that occurred, MSF, interestingly, for example, says, you know, it wasn't a question of money. MSF is a very well-funded organization. We have plenty of money to finance an intervention. The problem is that there really aren't enough trained people around to perform this kind of intervention, and there isn't an agency with the infrastructure and manpower to rush and build tent cities and to bring in trained nursing staff and protective staff. And so we asked the U.S. military to become involved in the intervention on Ebola, and the United Nations, UN here, eventually got involved. But how you coordinate the interactions between the response teams and the militaries, and what happens when you transition from military authority to civilian authority. And then the need to integrate the activities of the various organizations. People tend to think of the WHO, for example, as a response organization. But the WHO actually has a very small staff, even in its national offices. So the WHO acts as a coordinating enterprise. And how does WHO coordinate and interface with these other groups? You may also recall, and this was very shortly after our meeting, and many of the same characters participating, it was shortly after a meeting of the WHO Executive Board to consider how to improve global responsiveness to public health crisis. And frankly, many of the ideas and recommendations that were discussed in our meeting actually came out and were adopted in the context of the Executive Board report at the WHO meeting. And needless to say, that was neither the first nor will it be the last situation of this type. We currently have the Zika outbreak, and we're seeing again problematic issues arise in the response. Zika, of course, is very different from Ebola, and currently, you know, Zika tends to be a fairly slow-moving virus transmitted by direct human contact. But it's worth reminding, the same is true of HIV. HIV started as an isolated virus infection, and is slowly transmitted and yet developed into a global pandemic. So the fact that it's difficult to transmit Zika doesn't mean that this can't turn into a bigger problem. So the second major activity of this committee involved the UN Secretary General's high-level panel on access to medicine, and I don't know how many of you have followed this closely, but as you may be aware, in really November of 2015, the UN Secretary General Moon established a high-level panel of about 12 individuals with a mandate to review and assess proposals and recommend solutions for remedying policy incoherence between the justifiable rights of inventors, international human rights law, trade rules, and public health in the context of health technology. And the objective, particularly because Secretary General Moon will be leaving office at the end of this year, was to get to him a report by the end of June so that he could bring that forward to the UN system and get a report before the General Assembly before he leaves office. And I'll revert to what happened with that in a minute. But the first thing the high-level panel did, and I happened to be part of the expert advisory group to the high-level panel, so I participated in most of the sessions up until the final closed sessions of the committee, but they called for submissions by interested parties, and members of our committee decided that we would make submissions, that the committee would make submissions to the high-level panel, and we ended up making two submissions, the first for which our rapporteur, Ellen Matone, and our co-chair, Bridget Paredes, and myself, and another PhD candidate, put together was on access to essential medicines, and then Zavi, largely responsible for a framework agreement on pharmaceutical innovation and related protocols. And the call for submissions, the response, exceeded global expectations. In fact, in the end, there were close to 200 submissions made to the high-level panel. They were of a very high quality, bearing in mind that they were all prepared effectively over a period of 2 months. The expert advisory group and the committee sorted through all of these 200 proposals and then invited presentations at hearings held both in London and Johannesburg, and in fact the second set of hearings and global dialogue took place here in Stanton. I was here in March for that. It was webcast and so forth, and I know that Ruth was at the session in London. So there were meetings and global public dialogue held in London and Johannesburg, and you can see the dialogue session was webcast, but to my pleasant surprise of all of these 200 submissions, our two submissions of the Global Health Law Committee were selected for presentation at the hearing in London, and Ellen Matone and Zavi were in London to make presentations and field active questions by the high-level panel. So I'm going to discuss just for a few minutes our first submission, and then Zavi will go into more detail about the second submission. But our first submission concerned access to essential medicines. Again, I'm sure that many of you are familiar at some level with this area, but the WHO compiles and has for a long time compiled something called Essential Medicines List. And these are lists of medicines which all governments are recommended to have in stock with facilitated accessibility to the public, for priority health care needs of the country. And then national essential medicines lists are compiled on the basis of the WHO list. Over 150 countries have the essential medicines list. And our committee is very much concerned with human rights and access to medicines. The right of access to essential medicines is recognized as a core obligation under Article 12 under the International Covenant on Civil, Economic, Cultural, Social, and Cultural Rights, and per General Comment 14. So most essential medicines are available as generics, and most are available at reasonable prices, but there are some notable exceptions. Number one, and number two, there has been a trend now to increasing the number of medicines on the essential medicines list that are newer treatments and that are covered by patents, and these include newer antiretroviral treatments, treatment for hepatitis C, anti-cancer drugs, and TB treatments. For example, in 2015, 16 medicines were anti-cancer drugs were added to the essential medicines list, and some of those are very expensive patented drugs. So, for example, sofosbuvir or Sovaldi was introduced at a price of $84,000 for a 12-week treatment. Some of those anti-cancer drugs have prices between $100,000 and $250,000 a year. So how can we reconcile this idea of saying that access to essential medicines is a fundamental human right and governments should make these medicines available to the priority needs of the country, but they are unaffordable to the public health authority? Right? So our proposal was to seek to assure affordability of newer essential medicines, first by encouraging their voluntary licensing, and many of you may know that Ellen Cohen was the first executive director of the medicines patent pool, and to try to make them available in some manner through the medicines patent pool, but alternatively for national governments to set up systems of effectively automatic compulsory licensing, but then socially responsible royalties to assure availability based on capacity to pay. We believe that effectively automatic compulsory licensing can be accomplished through strict compliant measures, and we also suggested that as an alternative as well, to have an authoritative interpretation of the WTO of Articles 27 and 30 of the TRIPS Agreement to allow the exemption from patenting where appropriate of essential medicines. I don't want to take up much more time, so I'll just note that the high-level panel process has been fascinating. All of the stakeholders recognize the present system doesn't really fulfill all needs appropriately. We found in the hearings and presentations, it's not only developing countries by any means. The government of the Netherlands, for example, made a very detailed presentation about the difficulties the Netherlands is having coming to grips with its pharmaceutical budget as populations age. So we need more access, but we need also to promote innovation. And we have quite a few submissions about the human right to health and prioritizing health over commercial interest and establishing accountability, and quite a bit of discussion about delinkage. I've got that slide up there. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go over the delinkage concept here, but this was quite an important component of both what's going on at the WHO and things for future discussions among our committee. And what we were hoping in the context of this meeting was our committee would be proposing a resolution that would in some manner reflect on and promote the findings of the high-level panel report. Unfortunately, as of today, the report still isn't issued, and it's a month and a half behind schedule. And I note that the laws of time and space appear to preclude the proposal of a resolution based on a report that does not yet exist, so I'll call that Einstein's HLP paradox. And with that, so that's some of the work our committee has been doing, and now I'm going to turn the podium over to Ruth to discuss access.